Did you know using your browser in incognito mode doesn't actually protect your privacy? Take back your privacy with IPVanish VPN. Just one tap and all your data, passwords, communications, browsing history, and more will be instantly protected. IPVanish makes you virtually invisible online. Use IPVanish on all your devices, anytime you go online at home, and especially on public Wi-Fi. Get IPVanish now for 70% off a yearly plan with this exclusive offer at ipvanish.com/audio.
As our ambassador to the UN, Susan has been a tireless advocate in advancing our interests. She's reinvigorated American diplomacy in New York. She's helped to put in place tough sanctions on Iran and North Korea. She has defended Israel. She has stood up for innocent civilians from Libya to Cote d'Ivoire. She's supported an independent South Sudan. She has raised her voice for human rights, including women's rights. Put simply, Susan exemplifies the finest tradition of American diplomacy and leadership. So thank you, Susan, for being willing to take on this next assignment.
I'm deeply honored and humbled to serve our country as your national security advisor. I'm proud to have worked so closely with you for more than 6 years, and I'm deeply grateful for your enduring confidence in me. As you've outlined, we have vital opportunities to seize and ongoing challenges to confront. We have much still to accomplish on behalf of the American people, and I look forward to continuing to serve on your national security team to keep our nation strong and safe.
That was the voice of our very special guest this holiday season. Ambassador Susan Rice served as the 24th U.S. National Security Advisor from 2013 to 2017. Ambassador Rice was on the staff of the National Security Council and was the Assistant Secretary of State for African Affairs during President Bill Clinton's second term. A Brookings Institution Fellow, she served as U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations from 2009 to 2013. What I'm excited about, after all of that, which is a lot to talk about for sure, is her very personal journey, her very personal story, as she laid out in her new book, Tough Love, My Story of the Things Worth Fighting For. It is a real pleasure to welcome to the Michael Steele Podcast, Ambassador Susan Rice. Welcome.
Thank you, Michael. It's really great to be with you.
It's great to have you on. And I wanted to open up with that clip because I think it speaks to not just, you know, what you accomplished, but the journey that you traveled to that moment to stand there next to the president, to be elevated to the position of National Security Advisor, given your long service in the diplomatic corps. What was that moment like for you as you stood there probably reflecting on a whole bunch of little narratives in your life and saying, wow, you know, this little girl has grown up to be quite a woman?
I don't know if all that was going through my head, but it was a lovely moment. It was a beautiful day in June in 2013 in the Rose Garden, and my husband and kids were there, my brother and his family, my mom, who was then still alive. So it was really lovely. And I had spent 4.5 years with the privilege of serving as UN ambassador and living in New York. Mm-hmm. While my family stayed in Washington. So I was trying to commute home on the weekends. And one of the funnier parts of President Obama's announcement of me, apart from giving me due cred for my tennis game relative to his, was that he said that I'm probably the only national security advisor who, by taking the job, will be able to spend more time with their family. So it was... It was a homecoming as well. So it was a lovely occasion, and it was gratifying to be able to serve a president that I had enormous respect for and a country that I have, you know, deep love and reverence for, and do it in a really important role that in many ways symbolizes sort of the high point of a career in foreign policy and national security.
That's an interesting way to look at it, because when you stop and think about, you know, how journeys happen, a lot of people compartmentalize their lives in many respects. You know, there's like, okay, at this age or for this period, I did X, Y, and Z, and then I did, you know, and it is almost like, you know, a sort of a resume of things that I've done. But what I found interesting about your story, and particularly in the book itself, that you connect these dots and you go back and you talk about, you know, you really became like a little diplomat as early as age 7. So there were personal start parts of your life, which I like to get into, that sort of helped you actually be the kind of diplomat that you would become and the national security advisor that you would become. That idea of, okay, in tough situations, handling tough negotiations. Yeah, I know what that's like. Tell us a little bit about that part of the journey.
Well, thanks, Michael. You know, my story and my narrative in Tough Love is very much, as you indicated, a personal story. It's not, you know, only about policy or right. the issues we worked on and the successes and failures, although it definitely includes that. But it's a story that goes back to my parents and grandparents and where I came from, the daughter of a woman whose parents came from Jamaica to Portland, Maine in 1912 with nothing and managed to send all their 5 children to college. The descendant of slaves from South Carolina who miraculously had, you know, the opportunity to get a college education. My great grandfather, who was a slave and fought in the Union Army during the Civil War, was the first college educated person in our family. And he went on to found a school in New Jersey called the Bordentown School that for 70 years educated generations of African Americans. Mm-hmm. And so this family story is very important. And my personal experiences being born and raised in Washington, D.C.
Can I say a quick side note? 2 native Washingtonians here, folks. I, too, native Washingtonian. So I have a...
Where did you grow up, Michael?
I grew up in Petworth.
What was your neighborhood?
Petworth.
Okay.
Yeah, right off.
And I grew up in Shepherd Park.
Oh, okay. Yeah, there it is. Neighborhoods, baby. That's what we're talking about. I'm sorry. Just had a little D.C. love in there. But go ahead. I'm sorry.
No. Absolutely got to give love to D.C. But this is, you know, I grew up in Washington, D.C. Born in the mid-60s, grew up in the 70s and 80s. And all those factors shaped me. And I was very blessed to have 2 accomplished professional parents. But as you alluded to, I became a little diplomat at age 7 because they had a horrific marriage and, mm-hmm. and a very difficult and painful divorce and later long public custody battle. But, you know, I have a little, not so little brother anymore. I have a brother who's 2 years younger than me.
Right.
And we're all middle age now, so I shouldn't call him my little brother.
No, especially he's always your little brother. My sister's younger than me, and she calls me her little brother. So I get it's a sister thing.
He's a foot taller than me too, so that's another reason why I shouldn't call him that. But anyway, you know, my parents would have these very intense fights that sometimes got violent when we were little, and I would be at home in bed, you know, trying to fall asleep and be awakened by their screaming and yelling. And I'd sneak downstairs to kind of spy on them to see if their fight was likely to get out of control.
Right.
And if I thought it might, I'd intervene and sometimes physically intervene to separate them, but more often, you know, try to diffuse it by talking them down and hearing them both out and trying to find common ground or negotiate between them. And because I didn't know what else to do to try to, you know, prevent the situation from escalating. My brother was really too young and I felt like it fell to me. And so inadvertently at a very early age, I had more experience, you know, with mediation than a little kid should have to have.
Right.
And I've joked subsequently that I'd rather be dealing with the Russians and the Chinese than my parents at that stage of their lives.
Well, yeah, exactly. But I have to tell you, Susan, just that part of your story struck such a chord with me because I grew up in a family very similar. My dad, but it was driven from different pressures. He was an alcoholic and subsequently died of his alcoholism at 36 years of age.
Oh, wow.
But he was very abusive. I was younger than you at the time that our family was going through a lot of this. But I do remember, snippets from that period and the difficulties. But more personally, just the pain that I saw in my mother, in her face. And I remember a situation where I was playing on the floor, and my mother later told me this, because again, I was about four at the time. I was playing on the floor, and I just grabbed up this ball of fluff, and I started playing with this fluff, and I handed it to her, and she took it, and she started crying. And she told me later on why she cried, because I handed her a tuft of her hair that my dad had pulled out.
Oh, and, wow!
And so that kind of when I read that part, I was like, just like flashbacks, and how that shapes the person and the individual. And you go on and you say in a very, very clear way that you learned how to compartmentalize conflict, protect yourself emotionally and physically, and bounce back from adversity. And kids like us in that situation, that's what we kind of learn to do. We almost intuit it, don't we? It's an interesting
dynamic.
Well,
you have to, right?
Yeah.
I mean, it's a coping mechanism, obviously. But, you're absolutely right. I mean, you go through that stuff like that, and as challenging and traumatic as that might have felt for us in the context. I mean, obviously a lot of kids go through a lot worse, but I realized that, I wasn't going to be able to make my parents like each other, much less reconcile. But I could control to some extent, and as I tried to control to a maximal extent, my own behavior and right. how I reacted to it. Because like a lot of kids, when stuff is going wrong at home, I started acting out at school, and I had, difficult period in my friendships and all that sort of stuff. And I realized, I don't need to let that happen. I can focus on trying to, repair my friendships and not bring my anger to school, and, give my best in the classroom and, and on the athletic field. And so I realized that I do have some control. I do have some agency, mm-hmm. and I don't have to let this pain defeat me. And that resilience, and that confidence that I just developed, I guess, early in the teens, that I actually could take a hit and keep on running, was a very important lesson.
How did that? Coupled with the overall ancestral kind of connections that you draw from in the book, how did that influence your choices as a diplomat?
Well, I don't know if it influenced my choices. As I write in Tough Love, I had no expectation as a young person, or even as a graduate student, that I was going to end up in a career in foreign policy and national security. Having been born here in Washington, D.C. and raised and blessed to go to, excellent schools here and to know the children of senators and congressmen right. and ambassadors, and to have, as I mentioned, very accomplished professional parents myself, I had a very early interest in policy and in government. I write in the book that when I was 10, I decided I wanted to become a United States senator, mm-hmm. but being from Washington, D.C.,
good luck with
that. That was a bit of a challenge. We don't have any voting representation to this day.
To this day.
You know well.
To this day.
But by the time I was in my mid-20s, I realized, no, actually, at least at that stage in my life, that was not my ambition, because I hated the idea of raising money and begging people for help and all of that at that point in my development. But I still wanted to make policy. I still wanted to serve in government. And so for a long time, I thought that would be, you know, in the domestic realm. I thought I was going to go to law school and, you know, maybe be a civil rights lawyer, a public interest lawyer of some sort, and advocate for people who needed help. And I ended up going in a different direction, deciding to, after my master's degree in international relations, staying on to do a PhD rather than go to law school. And I write in a book about how Congresswoman Eleanor Holmes Norton, who at the time was a professor of law at Georgetown, this was before she went into politics, mm-hmm. took me out to lunch to help talk me through my next steps between my master's degree and you know, either law school or PhD. And she went through this whole Socratic process with me where she made me realize that I could and should pursue my interest in international relations, and I could get a PhD in relatively short order, given that I was studying in the United Kingdom, and it's a bit of a swifter process.
Right.
And if I still wanted to go to law school, I wouldn't be too old to go. But anyway, I took her advice, but then I ended up doing the PhD, but not going to law school, and worked as a management consultant for a few years. And then when President Clinton was elected, because I'd worked 4 years earlier on the failed Democratic presidential campaign of 1988, Mike Dukakis, as some will recall, I had two offers to actually join the Clinton administration, one in economic policy and one in national security policy. And after some deliberation, I picked national security policy, and that ended up being the path that I stayed on. But it was really not a grand plan, and the only grand plan was that I wanted to serve in government and to try to make things better for people.
Well, it's that sense of service that, you know, motivates and drives a lot of folks, particularly in this diplomatic space. And we saw a witness to that just recently from various, you know, diplomats and State Department officials who've testified publicly to their service and, you know, and how they, you know, what motivates them, the sense of legacy, the sense of family, you know, a lot of them have, you know, families who came to the U.S. not 100 years ago, but 50 years ago, 30 years ago, 20 years ago, and they, you know, they benefit from that, from the fruits of that. And that comes across in your stories, in the book, which sort of begs for me the question, you know, how did you approach some of the more challenges that you had in the roles that you served in, particularly as National Security Advisor, but, you know, in an administration that had to deal with South Sudan, Somalia, Libya, and the conflicts and issues that were going on there? What was your sense of failure or accomplishment in spaces like that?
Well, to take the period when I served as National Security Advisor in President Obama's second term, just to sort of isolate a period of mm-hmm. time, it was an extraordinary era because we faced it almost literally on the day that I took the job, which was July 1st, 2013, a crush of really challenging crises. You know, the coup in Egypt literally occurred on the day that I took the job. The Snowden revelations came out that same week, and then we had the use of chemical weapons in Syria the following month, and just a one thing after another. You know, within my first year, the Russian invasion of Ukraine, the rise of ISIS, and so we were, you know, very aggressively having to fight multiple fires simultaneously, then the Ebola epidemic, et cetera. And at the same time, we wanted to do some important positive things that we believed would leave the United States and the world safer and better. So we had what I'd call an affirmative agenda, which included things like trying to deal with the Iranian nuclear threat, or the Paris Climate Agreement or the Trans-Pacific Partnership or the opening to Cuba and, you know, supporting and training young leaders throughout the developing world. There are a whole series of affirmative actions that we wanted to invest in and accomplish at the same time as we were having to deal with this crush of and often unforeseen crises. And it was really a big, huge challenge to do both at the same time. It's hard enough to manage the inbox of crises that you may not have expected to land on your plate. But what I tried very hard to do, having had, you know, experience early in my career working at the National Security Council and a lot of experience subsequently at the State Department and at the UN, was to organize our efforts in such a way that, one, we had a pretty quite intense battle rhythm of principles committee meetings. This is the cabinet level national security decision making body that makes recommendations to the president, you know, the Secretary of State, Defense, the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs, CIA, blah, blah, blah. And we would meet at, you know, on average two or three times a week to wrestle with many of these challenging issues. And at the same time, I tried to empower our envoys and our staff to be working in parallel on the things that may not be in the headlines, but where if we made meaningful progress, we would be leaving things in a better place, you know, enhancing nuclear security, you know, implementing something we call the global health security agenda so that, you know, when diseases arise in the developing world, they don't spread untended, but there's an opportunity to detect and contain them before they, you know, get too far, all these kinds of things. And so it was really trying to figure out how to walk and chew gum at the same time on a, you know, a chorus of issues that any one of which could have been overwhelming.
How do you sort of address, so, you know, obviously we've been dealing with the whole issue with Ukraine and current administration likes to dump back on the Obama administration just because they think it's sport. But the reality of it is there was a different policy mindset regarding that region, specifically Ukraine at that time, with respect to their defense and their relationship with Russia than today. Could you speak a little bit to that to sort of help contextualize how the administration looked at dealing with a country who is, you know, we have a relationship with clearly, but there's so much in the news today with a different set of policy goals and outcomes.
Well, I'm happy to, Michael, but what's so interesting is the actual national policy goals are very consistent today as they were in the Obama administration. Ukraine policy had been and should remain, you know, wholly a bipartisan policy. We all recognize that Russia poses a proximate threat not only to Ukraine, which it, you know, invaded and continues to occupy through proxy, but to many of the countries on NATO's eastern front. We've seen their, you know, military involvement in Syria and now Libya.
Right.
Russia is about the bit, and their efforts to destabilize democracies in Western Europe and interfere in our electoral process, in our democracy on a daily basis. Russia is exporting instability, conflict, and an effort to usurp us and to become a global hegemon at our expense. There hasn't been, until very recently, any ambiguity about Russia's intentions. And Ukraine was, you know, a proximate victim of Russian aggression. And it had been the Obama administration's policy and supported on a wholly bipartisan basis by Congress, by our European partners, by the International Monetary Fund and the other international financial institutions. The aim was to support a newly emerging democratic government, to help them, one, have the wherewithal to stand up to Russian aggression. So that involved security assistance, military support. Secondly, to help them establish a more responsible, accountable government, and that meant fighting corruption with the new government, to help Ukraine find a path so that it could become more integrated into Western European economic structures and political structures. We were all in agreement on that. And that was, in fact, the Trump administration's stated policy as well. But then what we've learned subsequently is that rather than be clear about Russia as the adversary and Ukraine as the victim and the partner that we aim to support, we've had a president who's been very laudatory of Putin and Russia and inexplicably supportive of Russia's policy objectives and very hostile to Ukraine. If you follow what the administration's policies have been, they've been very consistent. And in fact, this is one of the areas where they like to, distort the Obama administration's record, because President Trump decided to provide anti-tank weapons to Ukraine belatedly, but under pressure from many on his team and in Congress. They claim that we never provided them the Ukrainians anything militarily other than blankets and I don't know what else. That's not true. We provided radar batteries. We provided all kinds of military equipment.
Right.
But we did take a decision not to provide those anti-tank weapons. And, for a variety of reasons that I can explain. But the point is, they took the policy that we had implemented and took it one step further with respect to the anti-tank weapons, which was arguably appropriate in the time that the mm-hmm. Trump administration decided to do it. I don't dispute that at this point.
Right.
But the irony is President Trump himself was running a personal policy through Rudy Giuliani and others that bore no resemblance to the national policy.
Right.
The personal policy was to screw Ukraine to the wall in order to extort false information on a political opponent for the president's own personal political interest.
Ambassador Yovanovitch made very clear during her testimony, among others. Yeah,
so it's
exactly.
It's not that U.S. policy changed. It's that Trump was running a side policy that was purely for his personal benefit. And then when he got exposed, the entire Republican Party tried to pretend that it was a different policy that they had always endorsed, which is just not true.
We are having a great conversation with Ambassador Susan Rice. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to finish up with a little fun with the ambassador. I got a couple of questions about dancing with diplomats. I don't know. It'll be interesting. We'll be right back after a quick word from our sponsors. All right, Ambassador Rice, so you got all serious and deep in the book. There's no doubt about it. But you also had a little bit of fun.
I hope I had more than a little bit of fun.
you know, you're a sister that I can appreciate for a whole number of reasons, starting with your response to the coach who used the N-word with you, which I thought was most appropriate. Starting with the letter F, you clarified the matter for him very quickly. But you talk about a number of other aspects of life. It wasn't all just diplomacy and meetings and national security. You've had some fun along the way, and I was particularly interested in sort of the raucous dance parties among bureaucrats, which I've been in a few of those rooms. And yeah, I don't know if I would call it raucous. Maybe your crew was traveling a little bit different than the ones I've been with. So talk a little bit.
Well, I hope so. So here's the thing, Michael. First of all, the stuff that we work on is so damn serious.
I know.
If you can't laugh, if you don't have a sense of humor, if you can't find fun in it, it's going to make you crazy.
Right.
So,
exactly.
I mean, one thing I always have been about is having a good, fulsome belly laugh, and even to the point of crying when things are funny enough to justify it. And so having a sense of humor and using a sense of humor even in or arguably especially in the toughest diplomatic moments is something that I found worked very well, and it also just made me enjoy what I was doing more. But in the same vein, I've always loved dancing, and especially old school R&B, funk, Motown, all that. And you know, I just, if I get the opportunity, I'm going to throw a dance party. Or I'm going to try to be on somebody else's dance floor. And so it turns out that a lot of people like to dance. They just don't necessarily associate it with the work of diplomacy.
Right.
And so I as a regular matter, through dance parties when I was ambassador of the United Nations, whether we were celebrating the independence of South Sudan or, you know, some colleague's departure, we had a great space on the top floor of the U.S. mission. And
oh, that's so cool.
You know, we figured out an excellent playlist and we would just do it and get funky and sweaty and have a lot of fun.
Oh my gosh.
And similarly, you know, we did, when I became national security advisor, my predecessor, used to have these very, formal staid Christmas parties with not much alcohol and a nice proper string quartet from the, you know, from the military,
right,
playing very sober music. And, you know, people would have a very quick drink and nobody would bring their families and they'd leave and they'd, you know, I was like, we're not doing that. So I changed up the whole damn thing.
Well, see,
I said, bring your family. We're going to have tons of liquor, bring food from all the different regions that you work on. And we're going to have a sweaty dance party with a no kidding DJ. But, and we kept the military band. But we put them in a different room,
right,
and we got a jazz band rather than having a string quartet.
Put them over there in the corner over there, and we all going to be in the room over here. And you know what? You know that scares the hell out of folks. Oh, Lord, here come the black folks. Oh, my God, what they going to do? We just keep it real.
But you know what, Michael? It became the most popular Christmas party
of course
all
it did.
The institutions in the White House. And it was a serious throwdown. And you know, we opened it up to all the, you know, for the nerds from OMB or from, you know, the Council on Economic Advisors or, you know, all these other parts of the components of the White House, the U.S. Trade Representative might, you know, have their little proper party.
Right. So you clear
they
the floor.
Had their proper party, then they came to ours.
You clear the floor. You move all the furniture to make sure, just in case any of them dance like Elaine from Seinfeld, you just want to make sure that if they if they're flailing about, no one gets injured. I love it. That is so much fun. And you have been just a real joy to talk to. I really appreciate you're taking time and sharing some of your story with the folks who visit this podcast. I've always been impressed and admired your work, your service. We've had our battles, certainly back in the day, you know, but at the end of the day, you're a standout, stand-up public servant, and appreciate your time of service to the country very much.
Thank you so much, Michael. I think you know this, but I want to say it for the benefit of the listeners. The admiration is extraordinarily mutual.
I always appreciate
you and your principled leadership. You call it the way you see it. And, you know, you served this country and your party with distinction, and I admire you enormously.
Well, thank you very much for that. And I wish you and your family nothing but the happiest of holidays. Be safe. Enjoy.
Merry Christmas.
And kick back, baby. Kick back. Little old school jam up at the Rice's.
Take good care. Thank you so much.
All right, yeah, folks. That does it for this episode of the Michael Steele Podcast. Be blessed. Y'all have a happy holiday. We'll catch y'all in the new year.
Your local Health Mart pharmacy is putting the personal care back in healthcare. We know you by name, not by refill number. Visit healthmart.com for the location near you. Health Mart, caring for you and about you.